It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's a very good time to be a history nerd in the state of Iowa. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll learn about History Camp, which is coming to Des Moines on November 14th. But first, the new Iowa Culture app puts Iowa history and cultural attractions in the palm of your hand. And Jessica Rundlett is the Special Projects and Outreach Coordinator for the Iowa State Historical Museum. She was very involved in developing this app, and she is here with me today. Hello, Jess.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you for being here. I hear you just got in from the fair, so a busy day.
Yes, we led a historic walking tour, 1K with the Healthiest State this morning, showing off some of the fantastic historical buildings at the state fairgrounds that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
Nice. And a lot of those are probably listed on the Iowa Culture app. Give me kind of an overview. What is this app about?
So Iowa Culture is a brand new mobile app that features arts, history, and culture from all across the state. We have just over 3,500 points across Iowa, and we're adding more to that every day, showcasing everything we've got here.
All right. And when I open up the Iowa Culture app on my phone, I can see all of these different categories: cemeteries, historic ballrooms, historic barns and farms, historic bridges, historic districts. There are lots and lots of categories. How did you decide what categories you were going to include on the app?
We started really broadly and ended up narrowing it down to about 20 categories really that fit within the mission of the Department of Cultural Affairs.
And I was just listing the history categories. There are three overarching categories: the arts, history, science, and nature. And under history, there are all of those different categories, but there are also categories that subcategories under those other overarching categories as well. I'm tripping all over myself right now. But so these are things all over the state of Iowa. When you came up with all of these different categories, then how did you go about finding the points of interest that you wanted to include?
Well, we started with the list that Travel Iowa has in their Iowa tour guide. And we also worked with the State Historic Preservation Office, which is part of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. And we listed almost 2,000 sites from the National Register of Historic Places. And it's also been a lot of boots on the ground work, people out in the state finding new places to add. We've spent a lot of time traveling the state to take photos of the locations that are included in the app and vetting the places, making sure that they really are points of pride. And far and away, most of what we've found has been great. And what we found is when we're out and about, there's more things in every Iowa town and community. We found so many veterans memorials. And one of the really great things we found that we're adding are the Freedom Rocks, painted by Bubba Sorensen from out in Adair County.
So when you add something to the app, do you have to confirm it before you include it? I mean, I know that there are, of course, at the Iowa State Historical Museum, there are lots of things that will tell you about places around the state. Are you double checking everything before it gets included in the map?
Yes, we're double checking, triple checking, and verifying so that we can feel really good about where Iowans and non-Iowans are going to visit when they use this app.
Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that you can use this as a guide if you're going on a road trip. You say you're going, you know, somewhere in Iowa and you want to pick some points of interest to hit along the way. But you can also just click on the app wherever you are and allow it to use your location and just see what's around you. So you may even discover some new things about your hometown or a place that you're really familiar with. How do you envision people using the app?
Well, I certainly hope that Iowans and Iowa natives will use the app to rediscover their local communities. And we're also hoping that people will use it to find more about where they're from, learn more about Iowa, and really have those aha moments that, yeah, we have a lot here. We have a lot to be proud of. And that by using this app, people will begin to care more about our historic sites. We already have a really active preservation community in Iowa. But hopefully with adding this layer of technology, we'll add a new generation of preservationists.
Are there any people, some of the things that show up on the app, especially when you're looking at historic farms or barns, these are things that are in private hands. Are there any people who've asked that they not have their site included on the app?
We have not run into that yet, but if someone contacted us, we certainly would remove a site at the owner's request. We do have a disclaimer within the app saying this is private property. Please respect the owners.
In your research in putting this app together, what have been some of the surprises for you? I know you know a lot about Iowa history already.
I think that has been the biggest surprise, at how much I didn't know about Iowa and how much we found. There are just some really phenomenal places we found in this state. And one of my favorites are the Chautauqua Pavilions. We found three remaining Chautauqua Pavilions, one down in Fremont County in Riverton, one in Red Oak in Montgomery County, and one in Sac City. And the one in Red Oak and the one in Sac City we knew about. That Riverton one of my coworkers just found when she was down in southwest Iowa. And I just love these buildings because there's such a physical remembrance of the Chautauqua movement from when it was a major cultural influence here in the Midwest.
And so they still remain. Are they just considered park structures now, or what are they in present day?
Most of them are just considered park structures right now. I don't know any that have an additional use, but I would love to find one.
Now, I know that sort of the official launch for this app is coming up next week on Monday, but you've done a soft rollout during the summer, and you introduced a lot of people to the app on RAGBRAI, which seems there are a couple – there's a great use for it because, of course, you're in parts of the state that you wouldn't necessarily be in. Of course, I can imagine cell phone coverage isn't always great when you're on RAGBRAI, but
right.
Were you using the app yourself when you were on RAGBRAI?
I went on a bit of a history nerd scavenger hunt on RAGBRAI. We had a featured tour on the app of arts, history, and culture locations close to the RAGBRAI route that you could see without expending any extra pedaling on your bicycle. And I set out to take selfies at all of those places. And I used the app to help pinpoint their locations.
So how many places did you visit? Do you know?
I think I visited between 30 and 40.
All right. So there were a lot of places along the way
that
you could see. And I know that the places really range from, oh, look, there's a barn, or, hey, something interesting happened here, to, oh, here's a museum where you can actually go in and learn about history. How do you encourage people to use the app to figure out how in-depth they can go?
Well, I would encourage people to use the app to learn more about places, to pique their curiosity, to actually go visit. And I like to think of it as people can use the app as armchair tourists and get excited to be out and about in Iowa.
Now, there are a couple of hidden gems that you're particularly proud of that are on the app. One is a lodge in Okoboji at Gold Point. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I love the lodge at Gold Point State Park. It's our largest state park lodge in the state, and it was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was part of President Roosevelt's public relief programs in the 1930s. Here in Iowa, we had almost 100 CCC camps full of unmarried, unemployed men working to advance the cause of conservation. They built lodges, they built trails, and it's said that they advanced the cause of conservation in our state 100 years, just in the 10 years the CCC was in existence. And the lodge at Gold Point is the biggest lodge they've built. It's right on the shores of West Lake Okoboji. The DNR has recently rehabilitated it, and it is just a fantastic venue.
And I can imagine it's a place that a lot of people go without knowing anything about its history.
Yeah, I think a lot of people bypass our state parks lodges, but all over the state, they are really phenomenal, phenomenally constructed buildings that blend in with their natural landscape and just are real gems.
Now, you have another one that you want to talk about, the Visitor Center in Creston?
Yes, the Frank Phillips Visitor Center in Creston. It's an old gas station, and now it's a visitor center, but it's one of the first Phillips 66 gas stations in Iowa. And I love the story behind it. Frank Phillips started life as a Southwest Iowa farm kid. He was an entrepreneur, bought all three barbershops in Creston, and married the bank president's daughter.
Wow.
I think that was a good plan from him because he, his brother, and his father-in-law started the Anchor Oil and Gas Company in Oklahoma and struck oil. They consolidated all their holdings into Phillips Petroleum Company, and he was a billionaire. He lived out the rest of his life away from Southwest Iowa, but maintained connections to the community. And in 1996, that Phillips 66 gas station on Highway 34 in Creston was restored, complete with period gasoline pumps and its Phillips original colors of orange and green. And that's when I just love that story, because it's the story behind the place. And that's really what we're trying to get to with the app.
Now, when I was playing around with the app and looking just around my neighborhood, I was using the cemeteries filter because I live out in the country and there are lots of small rural cemeteries that actually aren't on the app yet. So if you know of something in your neighborhood or in your part of the state that's not on the app, what do you do? How do you get in touch?
You can submit a place or submit photos of a place that is already on the app through the Iowa Culture app, or you can navigate to www.iowacultureapp.com and submit places that way.
All right. And how much more work do you feel there is to be done on this app? There's already so much work that's gone into it, but clearly it's still growing.
Yeah, it's growing. We're really excited to have Iowa Culture as a dynamic way to share Iowa and just to always keep adding and changing. It's with all the arts, history, and culture we've got in this state, I think I can confidently say that we will never be able to say the Iowa Culture app is totally done and complete.
All right. And we are going to be talking about History Camp coming to Iowa in November in just a moment. And you're going to be presenting on the Iowa Culture app at History Camp, right, Jess?
Yes, we'll have a presentation about the Iowa Culture app and probably play a little bit of Iowa Culture app trivia.
Oh, so nice.
Start studying now.
Download now and start studying. All right. Jess Renlett, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Jess Renlett is the Special Projects and Outreach Coordinator for the Iowa State Historical Museum. She was very involved in developing the new Iowa Culture app. And, of course, you can look for that on whatever mobile device you have and learn more about the state of Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to get a preview of History Camp, which is coming to Iowa in November. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's been called a Comic-Con for history nerds. We're talking about History Camp, which is a fairly new idea, and it's coming to the Iowa State History Museum in Des Moines on November 14th. People can already register. You can find out more about it on our Facebook page. We put up a link. It's a one-day event, and it's a great opportunity for history lovers of all ages to gather and learn about Iowa history. People can also submit to present at Iowa History Camp. And with me right now is Leo Landis. He's the state curator of the Iowa State Historical Museum and a big reason that History Camp is coming to Iowa. Hi, Leo.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Now, History Camp is a pretty new idea. The first one was held just in 2014 in Cambridge. Then there was one in Boston. So this is something that originated on the East Coast. It's not very old. How did you find out about this?
Lee Wright, who's an alumnus of Drake University and a Des Moines native, had launched it. Lee has another career, but he loves and is passionate about history. So he has a historylist.org website, and he wanted a way to share and promote history, seeing how other fields of study were being emphasized both in a public sphere, but also in a elementary and middle school and high school sphere. He wanted to make history raise its importance, and so decided to host History Camp in Cambridge, as you said, in 2014, and also do one in 2015. But as a Drake alumnus, Danny Ackright, who's really the founder, along with Leah, of History Camp Iowa, and Hope Grebner from Drake, started talking, and they brought me in as well, and wanted to get the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs in. But it is a separate entity started by Lee and then grabbed onto by Danny and Hope, and also Megan Bendixson and Dan Rasmussen.
Now, you, of course, are a historian, and I'm sure that there are many historical gatherings and conferences, places where historians get to share information with each other all the time. But that's not really the idea behind History Camp. And this is a place to celebrate and learn about history, but it's not just for people with degrees like yours, right?
It's an unconference. It's part of the unconference movement, as you said, for history nerds. So we would love to have high school students submit proposals, or undergraduates or grad students, or people like David Conan, who works at Living History Farms, who's one of the presenters. And I know you're going to talk to a couple of other folks today. But anybody who cares about Iowa history or U.S. history or any topic can submit a proposal. So it is. It's designed for anybody who loves history.
And really a wide variety of ages as well. You think kids can get something out of this too?
You know, I would think your daughter, if she wanted to learn about some history topics and have a good time, because it's people who are passionate about history, and I think you'll see that in all of our voices as you talk to people today and meet the folks involved with History Camp, that we know how to talk to different audiences, and it really can be fun for anyone.
Well, she's already sold. She says she wants to go, so we don't have to convince her. But tell me what you envision the day to be like. I know that you're not the only one involved in planning this, but if I sign up for History Camp and I come to Des Moines on November 14th, what's the day going to be like?
Right. Well, we'll have registration, of course, beforehand, as you mentioned, and you can do that through historycamp.org, and there's the Iowa 2015 tab on the left side. So you'll want to register and take care of that. And then when you come to Des Moines on the morning of the 14th, we'll have registration in the historical building. And then as an unconference, you get to pick and choose. We aren't planning right now on having a keynote. There will be a welcome and might ask folks just to say your first name and where you're from and why you're there. And so that way everybody at least gets a chance to participate in one big group. And then the sessions will start and there will be concurrent sessions. We're hoping for somewhere between 30 and 40 sessions total. And that way there will be a broad variety. So if you see a session that interests you, you can start there. And it's like, oh, that wasn't going the direction I thought. You can pick and choose and nobody will take offense, and you might pick another session.
Well, and I was looking at the slideshow from History Camp Boston, and I noticed there were a few people in period dress from various periods, because this doesn't really focus on one period in history. It's whatever part of history you want to really focus on. So there is a little cosplay if we're going to go ahead with the comparison to Comic-Con, right?
I thought of that term too, Charity. So if there's someone who, you know, likes to reenact a period of history and wants to submit a proposal that is, you know, 14th century Africa, we would love to have you. Or any topic that relates to history that you're passionate about and you want to speak about, and you can do it in under 30 minutes, we would love to have you submit a proposal.
All right. And how do you decide who to accept? I mean, somebody submits a proposal. How do you vet that person?
As an unconference, we're trying not to be too heavy-handed. So if you're passionate and you demonstrate a real interest and a level of expertise, we'll put you on the program.
And have you decided what you're wearing?
I've got some good 19th century stuff, and I don't have my own baseball uniform because I do some historic baseball work, but I've got some 1850s farm clothes that if I just dress up, I could do that.
All right. Well, Leo, stay with us. I'm talking to Leo Landis, who, of course, is a frequent guest on this program. He's the state curator of the Iowa Historical Museum, and we're talking about History Camp, which is coming to the Iowa State Historical Museum on November 14th. You can find out more about that. Follow the link on our Facebook page. You can also go to historycamp.org, and there you can find out about History Camp coming up in Iowa, but also about the history camps that have taken place already. And this is only going to be the third History Camp itself. Leo, why? I mean, I understand that the originators have some Iowa connections, but Boston does seem like one of those historical nexuses. Why Iowa?
That's part of the whole initiative that Jessica was talking about with the cultural app. We recognize, from now speaking as an Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs person, that we're about the history of the whole state and promoting history. And that's where the Department of Cultural Affairs and the Historical Society felt like this was a great fit for us. And even if it's not an Iowa history topic, we know we're going to get those. But to promote people's interest in doing great and engaging history is what History Camp is about and what Lee and Danny and Hope and all of us are about. And it fit right in with what the Department of Cultural Affairs is trying to do with our emphasis on 99 counties and appreciation for Iowa arts, history, and culture.
All right. And I am going to talk to a couple of people who are going to be presenting at History Camp. But can you give me an idea so far what kind of topics you're hearing about?
Sure. We hope, and we've got some tentative commitments that aren't listed on the History Camp page yet, but just to talk about the breadth across the site, some folks from southwest Iowa down in Adams County talking about the Icarian utopian movement down in Corning, and that'll be on the program, hoping to talk about the Mormon handcart and the trails across the southern part of the state from some public historians, but also then Jerome Thompson, our state curator, who's recently retired, is going to share a great story about Edgar Harlan, who was a historian and a curator in the early 20th century, who really built the connection with the Meskwaki tribe that's the part of our state's culture that is really great. And then we've got people like David Conan, who have talked about Iowans who served in the Confederacy, Megan Stout-Sabell, who's with Salisbury House, talking about that great site. So it'll be a broad range of programs.
Well, I want to bring Pamela Riney-Kerberg into the conversation now. She's a history professor at Iowa State University. Hello, Pamela.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, you are very welcome.
And you are going to be delivering a presentation at History Camp on the childhood, Midwestern farm childhood, particularly during the 1870s through the 1920s. When did you first hear about History Camp?
Well, Leo got a hold of me 6 weeks ago or so and said, Pam, would you like to do this? And I thought, okay, I will go ahead and do this.
And just tell me about your first impressions. I don't know. As a history nerd myself, when I first heard about it, I got pretty excited. So I'd love to hear your response.
Well, I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people who are passionate about history to talk about the things that interest them and to try and build the excitement around particularly Iowa history.
And Leo, I know with the first two history camps, there actually weren't professors or historians, official historians, who were presenting. And you went to Pam to ask her to present. Is that a different approach from the other history camps?
I think Lee would have put those folks on the program in Boston or Cambridge in Boston. One of the things I like to pride myself on as a public historian is that I recognize that academic historians like Pam, who's really a public historian too, but can reach out to broader audiences and the stories that they tell. Sometimes people get intimidated by people like Dr. Riney-Kerberg when you hear her called that, and that she's a real friendly person and has some engaging things to tell you about our past as Americans. And so I really wanted to get some of those academic historians involved.
Well, and Pamela, I can imagine that in your line of work, you're talking to a lot of academics a lot of the time, and of course, your students. And this seems like kind of an exciting opportunity to really bring your research to the public.
I've been interested in bringing what I do to the public all along. I appear on the radio. I've been on TV.
Right.
I love the idea of getting everybody interested. One of the best experiences I've had as a historian was going to my son's grade school and talking about this very topic with first graders.
And was this a no-brainer for you? Was this exactly the topic that you wanted to talk about?
Yes. I am really excited about the history of childhood, and it's something that people often don't think of as having a history. And having the opportunity to talk with people about children, in fact, having a history, often it's a new thing for them, and it makes them think completely differently about what is history.
Well, and we do have this approach to childhood in this day and age where we work very hard to protect childhood, and we have a lot of expectations for what kids need to be doing during childhood. And that was not the case during the time period that you're talking about.
Right. Absolutely not. What I love about childhood in the late 19th to early 20th centuries is that it so much defies all of what we believe childhood should be. We, for our children, put school first and play a very close second, and we often don't think of work as being part of a child's life. And that is exactly opposite of what happened in the period in the late 19th and early 20th century, when work was the most important thing and school and play came far distant in terms of the priorities that families had for their children.
So school was an afterthought and play even further down the list, I can imagine.
Yes, yes.
So you have gone through and found a lot of people who've shared their memories. Do you have some of those memories with us, with you today, that you could share with us?
Yes, I do. I've got some information gathered from memoirs of Iowans, some diary information, and also a letter that a young girl once wrote about her experiences playing.
Can you just briefly share maybe a little bit from that letter for us?
Okay. This is from a girl whose name was Olive Everts, and at age 10, she lived in Discord, Iowa. And she wrote, "We're having vacation now in our school. My little sister and I enjoy ourselves very much. Sometimes we go to the grove and hear the little birds sing and watch the little fish swim in the creek and the squirrels as they play around. And sometimes we go down to the hayfield and watch the men put up hay, which we think is nice fun. And then again, Mom makes us stay in the house and wipe dishes and do chores, which we think is not quite so funny. Every night I take a ride if I like it. It seems that we enjoy ourselves more than the little children that live in town."
When you have a firsthand account like that and you share it with children from today, what kind of reactions do you get?
They're often very surprised at how much time youngsters spent outdoors and how independent they were, because I always explain to people that play was an independent activity, often completely unsupervised by parents. And that astonishes people when I talk about the degree of independence that kids had, not just in their play, but also in their work. They were expected to know what needed to be done and to do it.
Well, and I can imagine that a lot of kids, the play was not only not supervised, but they probably tried to stay out of sight of their parents so they didn't get assigned more work.
That's right. If they could see you and they could hear you, then more than likely they would have work for you to do, because there was always more to be done.
So as you're gathering things together, I know that you've done so much work on this and shared it with many different audiences over the years. What are you thinking about for you? You only have a half an hour at History Camp. How are you putting that presentation together?
Well, I'll be talking about work and school and play, and really foregrounding what children themselves had to say about those experiences, because they wrote wonderful things and people remembered wonderful things about their experiences when they were young. And so I'm going to let the people tell their own stories.
And have you been talking to people already about the fact that you're going to be at History Camp? Are you getting reactions from other people?
Well, I've been mentioning it, particularly telling our students that this is going to be happening. And they sort of shake their heads and give me a funny look like, what is History Camp? So I think we need to get the word out that this is going to be happening and that it's open for everybody.
Well, and Leah, what kind of responses have you been getting? Obviously, you're telling a lot of people about History Camp. That's part of your business. How are people reacting?
All of us who have shared the message, at least in central Iowa and across the state, are getting really great reactions. And as I've talked about it with people in the Iowa Museum Association and other colleagues that I have across the state, I think there's a real excitement, and that the team of us, you know, would like to keep growing History Camp and having it happen again in central Iowa perhaps, but also taking it to other locations across the state at some point.
Well, and you reached out to Pamela to get her to be a presenter at History Camp. Are you doing a lot of recruiting?
I am, but all of us on the team are. But I'm of the group of us. Hope is also, you know, a professional historian or an archivist with the Harkin Institute at Drake. So she's got good connections too. But I'm the oldest of the gang, so my connections run a little broader.
And if you haven't already gotten a call, you should be expecting one from Leo or from one of the other members of the team in the near future. I know that registration is already open, and it is early in this process as you're just still recruiting people, and people are getting in touch with you who want to present. What kind of a response are you getting as far as registration goes?
It's really been a good start. We really plan to market hard beginning in early September, once the program is finalized, and or at least the broader the beginning program, where we're up around 25 to speakers or so, and can really tell folks, here's, besides Pam and Justin, who you'll be talking to, or some of the other speakers that we've recruited, here's what it's looking like, here's why you should come, and we think we'll have a good start.
I'm talking with Pamela Riney-Kerberg. She is a professor of history at Iowa State University. Leo Landis is also here. He is the curator at the Iowa State Historical Museum. We're talking about History Camp, which is coming to Iowa November 14th at the Iowa State Historical Museum. And you can find out more on our Facebook page. We've put up a link. You can also join the conversation, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of History Camp, which is coming to Iowa November 14th. It's a one-day event, an opportunity for history lovers of all ages to get together, learn from each other. Some people will be submitting presentations. Some people will just go to learn. It's coming to Des Moines on November 14th at the Iowa State Historical Museum. With me this hour is Leo Landis. He's state curator for the Iowa State Historical Museum, and Pamela Riney-Kerberg, a history professor at Iowa State University. Pardon me. And I want to bring another presenter into the conversation as well. Justin Alice is not a professional historian. He's a tax specialist with Iowa Workforce Development. He's also a history buff from Des Moines. Hello, Justin.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me how you heard about History Camp.
Well, I'm a Drake alum, I guess a three-time Drake alum, and when Drake started to kind of help sponsor this, I was asked relatively early on if I would be willing to come in and present, and I said, what would you like me to present on? It's like, come up with something fun. So that's hopefully what I've accomplished.
All right. And give me an idea of what kinds of things you're interested in.
Well, my goal for the presentation, I love local history, and I think that's out of necessity. We talk about Boston, how just exciting it would be to step out your door in Boston and, trip over Paul Revere and the North Church and those things. Well, we've got some great stuff here locally, just like we were talking with the cultural app. A lot of great stuff here locally that a lot of people don't necessarily recognize. So I'm going to come up with 20 things for the presentation that are within 20 minutes of Des Moines that are sort of little known. There's some great things like the Salisbury House that are fairly well known. I'm more kind of trying to find the things that aren't as well known, that, the areas we step over every day and don't think about.
All right. And you're keeping it very Des Moines-centric.
Correct.
And 20 things, you have a half an hour to present. So you're not planning to go super in-depth on any one of these things.
Absolutely. This is just going to be a very pinpoint, probably a picture if there's worth taking a picture of it. Here's the address. And whether or not it's worth stopping to see or not, one of my favorite ones, there's a spot on the Underground Railroad just east of the old Babcock Miller building, which is known right now for being a gravel parking lot where people park when they ride the shuttle to the state fair. Probably not that exciting to stop and see that, but it's worth noting.
All right. And kind of exciting to know that you're that close to history, right?
Correct.
So how are you going about picking these 20 things? What's your process?
Well, I've actually kind of just accumulated bits and pieces as I've read throughout throughout my existence, kind of George Mills approach. He used to be the Des Moines Register reporter, where he would just kind of file away neat little things as he found them, and he had the forum of the Des Moines Register to share some of these stories, as well as some books. So I think this is just an ideal forum to share some of the things, and of course, in doing so, undoubtedly we'll learn some things from other folks that have happened in the Des Moines area that just didn't get published very well.
All right, we're talking about History Camp right now on Iowa Public Radio, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. What are some of the topics that you would hope to learn more about if you went to History Camp? Are you interested in presenting and have questions? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And all right, we talked about that Underground Railroad stop. Can you give me another example of something that's making the list, Justin?
Amelia Earhart makes the list. She moved here with her family right around 1907. Actually lived at a couple different locations, roughly right in between where Leo and I live. We're neighbors. She grew up in the Drake neighborhood, lived in four different locations there, two of which are still in existence and are unrecognized currently, as in they are just residential houses that are in the Drake neighborhood. She saw her first airplane at the Iowa State Fair, so that sort of is worth noting. Ironically, at about the same time she saw her first airplane, future World War I fighter ace Eddie Rickenbacker was driving a race car at the Iowa State Fair. So Amelia Earhart makes the list.
Think probably a lot of people are really surprised to learn that she lived in Des Moines.
Well, she was from Kansas originally, and her father was an attorney working for the Rock Island Railroad. And so they traveled around as a result of that. And she was here certainly for some of her formative years, became very much part of the Drake community. Her parents were close friends with Drake professors, and they actually had a magazine sharing group where different people would subscribe to different cultural magazines. And when they were done, they would all switch between families.
And it was also kind of a difficult part of her life.
Absolutely. The family broke apart, and basically their family broke apart in 1914, and that's when she moved out of Des Moines.
Now, I just asked you a bunch of questions about this, but we spent about 3 minutes talking about it. Is it going to be hard to limit yourself on the various topics?
We may have to take the auctioneer approach to the questions when we actually give the presentation.
All right. Well, give me another example that makes the list.
Jack London was here, the famous author from The Call of the Wild, was here in 1894, actually essentially homeless, traveling across the country in a protest over the economic conditions in 1894. A lot of people don't realize that the economic downturn then was probably more severe than the Great Depression, but just didn't last as long. And so they were marching to Washington to raise awareness for the plight. And he kind of got stuck in Des Moines for a little while because they lacked funds, they lacked transportation. And so he spent some time and kept a very good diary of his travels across Iowa.
Oh, fascinating. I hadn't heard that one. How about one more?
The last one probably for me, Herman Hollis, FBI agent extraordinaire, handpicked by J. Edgar Hoover for what was considered to be the most dangerous work of the time, which was going after America's public enemies. These included Pretty Boy Floyd, John Dillinger, and Babyface Nelson. Herman Hollis was part of the team that actually killed John Dillinger. He's sort of peripherally featured in the movie Public Enemies with Johnny Depp. Later on, Herman Hollis was in a gun battle with Babyface Nelson, in which both he, Nelson, and another FBI agent were killed. Herman Hollis is buried in Des Moines. He was from Des Moines. He was 31 years old.
I'm talking with Justin Alice, who is an amateur historian in Des Moines. He also has a day job. I guess you moonlight as a historian, a day job with workforce development. Pamela, you know so much about Iowa history. As you're listening to Justin, does that give you ideas for things that you're hoping that other people will focus on? You'll be focusing on Midwestern farm childhood, but do you have some dream topics that you hope other people will pick?
Oh, boy. There's so many interesting things. As Justin was talking about Hollis, who was handpicked by J. Edgar Hoover to go after the big gangsters, I was also thinking about the Cow War that happened in Iowa in the early 1930s, where farmers who were resisting doing tuberculosis testing with their cattle basically went to war with the local authorities and hung Iowa State veterinarians in effigy. And that's always an interesting topic. There's just all sorts of fun stuff.
Well, you know, that story makes me think. And you know, talking to Jess Runlett at the beginning of the hour about some of the little things on the Iowa Culture app, there are all these very small stories about Iowa that are so fascinating but they're not necessarily pivotal to telling the bigger story about Iowa. And Leo, I'm curious, when you're trying to teach people about Iowa history, how do you balance, you know, looking at sort of the overarching picture and how Iowa fit in with the rest of the nation and some of the things that really shaped our state with some of the really fun stories like the Cow War?
The Cow War is part of, you know, the broader context of Great Depression programming and what's happening with on a local level. It can be manifested. I'm using bigger words than I mean to. Can be seen in the Iowa lens. And so even though it's a perhaps not a national story, it's how it played out here on our stage and then does translate to the national level. So whether it's, you know, Herman Hollis or Amelia Earhart, who are only here for, in Amelia's case, a short time, it does still shape their experience and you know, lets you see what a childhood in an urban area might have shaped a young woman's experience to be as she matured. So they really can shed light on the broader topic. It maybe sometimes is a stretch, but usually it does fit the broader context.
Here's a question from Bob in Cedar Rapids. He says, is there going to be anything about railroad history? I plan on going in November and I can't wait.
I don't think we've got anybody who's proposed that topic yet. So if Bob wants to do a topic, he would be great. And if not, that's something that we can put on the list and keep as that. I certainly the team knows folks who know that topic and we can reach out to the railroad historians. There's some good ones in Iowa. So if Bob wants to do it, he should submit his own proposal or we'll look too.
Well, and there are so many little niche areas like railroad history that people get, you know, it's the thing that they are excited about, that they are passionate about, and they are knowledgeable about. Bringing people who have that little pocket of interest together at History Camp, that I can imagine that will be very interesting to see where people gravitate because, you know, some of us kind of get stuck in the little thing that we care about so much and maybe aren't that interested in things outside of our specialty. Leo, do you have some thoughts on that?
Just getting back on that railroad topic, I mean, there's the big stories like Grenville Dodge and the Union Pacific Railroad, which obviously has national implications. But then you have local stories like Martin Flynn, who immigrates to Des Moines. He's a, you know, laborer when he starts and then builds a livestock farm in Urbandale that is today the centerpiece of Living History Farm. So you've got a local story like that who Martin Flynn really does play a national role. But you also then have, and I'm forgetting her name, her first name's Hope from Iowa State, and some of the research she did on professional women in small towns, some of those were connected to the railroad industry. And I'm trying to be discreet and delicate, but I think people understand what I mean when I say professional women.
Right. I think so, too. So one of the goals in bringing History Camp to Iowa, as you mentioned earlier, is that there has been less emphasis on social studies and the teaching of history in our public schools, which is something that I know you feel strongly about, Leo. And all three of you obviously became excited about history as you were growing up. Justin, I know this was something that was a big part of your childhood. Can you give us an idea about how you pursued that passion as a kid?
Well, my grandmother actually was kind of a legacy of a one-room school teacher. She taught in a one-room schoolhouse near Waukee in the 1930s and was very passionate about history. And when I was a young boy, she lived near, and I probably was at her house more than I should have been. I don't think she had any social life outside watching her grandson. And she was very, very good about taking me to meet people. So if I was interested in the Normandy invasion, she made sure she found somebody in the, you know, greater Adel area that, you know, had participated in Normandy. When I became interested in Bonnie and Clyde, she found someone from Dexter who was part of the shootout that I got to sit down and, you know, as an 8-year-old, have coffee with. So I was very lucky to have parents and grandparents that were, you know, very accommodating and, you know, you know, I needed someone who could drive, so they drug me around the state to the places I wanted to see.
Do you have some thoughts for parents about how to get their kids excited about history?
Well, for me, I moved into the Drake area last year with my kids, and you know, my oldest daughter had just got done reading a book about Amelia Earhart, so it's trying to make what they do read about in school have that local connection. And when there is the local connection, things come alive a little bit more, I think, for the kids. So it's just, you know, it's looking around and seeing, you know, what do I have near me? You don't have to take the kids on a cross-country vacation to find things that are very exciting and tie into, you know, local history. You know, we have a vice president that's buried a couple miles from my house. That's fairly interesting. You know, he grew up a couple miles the other side of my house. So those type of things, I think it's just, you know, we don't have to stretch very far to find the interest. And kids are fascinated with most anything if you present it in the right light.
Well, and Pamela, you were talking earlier about presenting to kids at elementary schools. I can imagine, particularly with your focus on childhood in Iowa, kids must get so fascinated because they can imagine themselves in the shoes of another child 100 years ago.
And I think that is so important to build that kind of imagination in them. What built the imagination in me was two different things. One was that when I was 8 years old for Christmas, I got Laura Ingalls Wilder's books. And all of a sudden, I was imagining myself in that 19th century world. But then also, I had a family that was full of storytellers. And the best part of Thanksgiving and Christmas was sitting at my grandmother's table and listening to her and her siblings talk about their childhoods and imagining what it must have been like for them growing up on these little impoverished Kansas farms and getting into that world. And I think if kids can apply their imagination to what it must have been like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, it's a wonderful opportunity to get them excited about history.
Now, I talked earlier about the fact that there is a little bit of cosplay that goes on, or costume play that goes on at the other history camps that have taken place before. And I know all of you are interested in figures from Iowa history. Who would you most like to encounter? Leo, is there a particular figure from Iowa history that, of course, you don't get to meet the real deal, but who would you be looking for?
Alexander Clark of Muscatine, no doubt. The individual who fought segregation in 1867 with his daughter Susan, helped raise the African-American corps of soldiers during the Civil War. He's somebody I would love to meet, or Lewis and Clark.
All right. How about you, Justin?
Oh, it's a tough one for me. Hoyt Sherman, I think, interests me probably the most. Again, you know, a person very local to where I live, but a man who was absolutely connected to just about everybody in the beginning of Des Moines history. Hoyt Sherman and his brother, whose name I forget, that was also a Des Moines resident.
LP. It's LP.
Thank you. You know, both grew up in the area, and I would have loved to have met any of the Shermans, or if their famous brother William Tecumseh came to visit, I'd probably would pick his brain a little bit too.
You could probably pull off one of those costumes. So maybe start planning now. Pamela, how about you?
Well, Laura Ingalls Wilder spent one of her least known childhood intervals in Red Oak, Iowa. And it was a much different life than the one that's described in her books. But I was also thinking about Billy Sunday, who was one of the biggest temperance advocates, prohibition advocates in the early part of the 20th century, who was quite a colorful individual from Ames, Iowa.
All right. So lots and lots of possibilities. Pamela Reine-Kerberg, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Pamela Reine-Kerberg is a history professor at Iowa State University. Justin Alice, thank you.
Thank you.
Justin Alice is a tax specialist with Iowa Workforce Development and a history buff. Both of them will be presenting at History Camp coming up in November. And Leo Landis, thank you.
Thanks so much, Charity.
Leo Landis is the curator of the Iowa State Historical Museum. History Camp is coming to Iowa November 14th. You can find out more at historycamp.org or follow the link on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.